I've relied rather heavily on one book this evening for what I'm going to say. Excellent book. Just might amuse you to know, when the book first came out, books get sent off to all sorts of people to be reviewed. And one of the people that reviewed the book said, it's a little disappointing that Mr. Jones doesn't go into as much detail on the Book of Esther as, and they quoted another book, which was roughly the size of that box. So there was a good reason. So we're going to go into even less detail tonight. But just a kind of overview of the Book of Esther. It's a fascinating book, I think. It's a book I've always been quite in love with, and for a number of reasons. God isn't mentioned in it. Not once. And yet, I would argue that no book in the Bible speaks to us more clearly of his gracious sovereign protection than the Book of Esther does. But he's not mentioned. No book, I think, has more to teach us about prayer. Some have just as much, but none has more, I think. And yet no prayer is recorded or reported. Some people will say, oh, there is. But if you look carefully at the text, there's references to them fasting, but not to them praying. So there's no reference to prayer. And throughout this book, the invisible God, I think, can only be seen by his footprints in history. You can see him acting. It's like the wind, isn't it? You can't see the wind, but you can see where it moves. You can see the effect that it has on the world around it. And the same is true, I think, of our God. And lastly, the hand that shields his people can only be perceived by faith. That there are various crisis moments in this book when it appears that God has abandoned his people altogether. It seems as if everything is lost and nothing can kind of redeem the situation. But God is always in control. He always knows what he's doing. That's the empire that is involved. Everything that's in green there on the screen. That's the empire. And in particular, the events are centered on Susa, which was the winter palace of the king. You can see how vast the whole thing is. It goes from what we would call modern day Greece down into Egypt, right across into India. It was a vast empire. And the armies that the Persians could put into the field have been estimated to run into millions. When Alexander the Great finally defeated the Persian Empire, it was with a relatively small army against an army that numbered over a million. Vast, vast army. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, or Artaxerxes, same guy. We think we're identifying the right person here, lived from 486 to 465. He was the emperor that failed to conquer Greece. You remember, he amassed this massive army, crossed over the sea, started to invade Greece, but eventually had to withdraw in defeat. He fought a great naval battle against the Greeks, which were not a nation at the time. They were a collection of city-states that bound themselves together, Sparta and Athens and others, and they managed to defeat this vast army, and Xerxes had to withdraw. And it was the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire. And like a lot of these people, he was eventually murdered in his bed by his son. So, let's have a look at the major characters in the book and just kind of identify who they are. So Xerxes, we've mentioned him. And then there's Queen Vashti. We'll have a little look. She's a controversial figure. Some people see her as a villain. Some people see her as a heroine. It all depends how you understand her reaction. And we'll have a little bit of a thought about that to declare my hand. I think she's more of a heroine than she is a villain. I'll explain my reasons why. There's, depending which school you went to, Mordecai or Mordecai. You can call him whichever you like. Then there's Esther, the main character and the one whom the book is named after. And then we all go, boo, Haman the Agagite. He's the villain of the pantomime, isn't he? Though this is no pantomime. Whoop, I've included Zeresh, Haman's wife, because she stands, I think, alongside Job's wife and probably Jezebel as giving the worst advice to her husband. It would be interesting to put them in a 1-2-3. There's Bigthana and Teresh. They're the plotters who are involved, and Haggai, the eunuch who Esther finds favor with. So those are the main sort of characters who form this drama. In calling it a drama, I'm not suggesting that it isn't historical. It is. I believe it's historically factual. Everything that the Bible tells us happened, but that doesn't make it any the less dramatic. It is a very dramatic story indeed. It starts with the conduct of the king in chapter 1. And I think he emerges in chapter 1 as a show-off. The extravagance of the banquet, if you look at the duration of the banquet in chapter 1, and the fact that, you know, this wine is just flowing, he's a little bit of a show-off. He's got everybody who's anybody gathered around, and he's a bit of a show-off. He's also, I think, a little bit of a drunkard, because the scriptures tell us, if you look at verses 7 and 8, that the problem begins when he has had a little bit too much to drink. He's merry with wine, verse 10. He's merry with wine, and he summons Vashti, his queen. She is engaged in queenly activities. She has the wives of all these men. They would not mix together in those days. And she is entertaining them. And he's shown off, really, all the treasures of his vast kingdom. They've seen the gold. They've seen the silver. They've seen the opulence. They're sitting on couches or seats made of gold and silver. The best of wine is kind of flowing. We know from historical sources that they actually had kind of fountains that were just wine, in the way that you'd normally have a fountain of water. They had fountains of wine and so on. And they get drunk. And I think it's fair to say, in my view, he fails as a husband, he fails as a king, and he fails as a man. Because the key thing is that he wants to parade Vashti so that his semi-drunk companions can see how beautiful she is. There was a pop song, I think, in the 1960s, which had within it the phrase, "And when I go out with you, don't put me on display. You don't own me." And that is kind of what's going on here. He summons Vashti so that everybody basically can ogle her. What a beautiful woman. This is part of his possessions, part of his treasures. And I think he fails as a husband in doing that. I think he fails as a king because he does not maintain the dignity of his own queen. Can you imagine a king demeaning his own queen? She's not his only wife. He's got lots of those. But she's the queen. She's the crowned head alongside him. And he just wants to use her as an object for his friends to admire. And I think he fails as a man. God's mandate to men, isn't it, is to protect women, to care. care for them, to love them, to cherish them. And he fails absolutely to do that. The contrast with Christ, I think, is fairly kind of obvious, isn't it? We are the bride of Christ. He does not fail us. He beautifies us, but not so that people can kind of ogle us, but that people might be able to see the grace and the goodness of God. As a king, he is the servant king who rules on behalf of his people. It's not that they serve him. He comes and he serves. And of course, as the last Adam, the new man, he completely triumphs. So Xerxes, not that good. Esther 1:19, therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed. We'll see in a moment that Vashti's refusal to appear sends not just the king, not just those that are gathered around, but actually sends ripples through the entire empire. And something very, very important is recorded here in chapter 1, verse 19, which will figure in the whole story. And it's simply this, that the Persians didn't have the common sense to do what we do, for instance. No government can bind its successors in perpetuity. Whatever the government decides to do, it can decide to undo. But the law of the Medes and Persians was that once it's been decreed, it cannot be changed. Which is okay if you're God and you never make a mistake, but is pretty disastrous if you're men and you make as many as human beings do. So that's a verse just to keep in our minds. So the fall of Vashti. The queen refuses to come. She tells the king very politely, but very firmly, no. The king is angry about that. He's not used to people saying no. He's a little bit of a spoiler. I mean, all kings in those days were bound to be, weren't they? Because nobody ever said no to them. And here is his queen, his wife, a woman, saying no. And it makes him a little bit cross. So they have a crisis cabinet meeting. What are we going to do? And essentially, they feel that the whole of civilization is now in danger. The argument goes very simply, very straightforwardly. If the queen can get away with it, anybody can get away with it. And these men suddenly see domestic kind of chaos ruining, because you have to remember that women were possessions, they were chattels, they were owned by their husbands, still under Islamic law. They've just changed it, haven't they, in Pakistan, that a man can't simply divorce his wife by saying, I divorce you. He's got to do a little bit more than that. But that was the kind of status of women. And they're in absolute panic. Civilization, as we know it, is about to end. What are we going to do? So the advice that's given to Xerxes is very simply, get rid of her. Let her see your face no more. Take the crown off her head and give it to another. Put her into internal banishment within the harem, basically. And he signs a decree to this effect, that she will never see him, he will never see her again, and she is not to be queen. And of course, it's a verdict out of self-interest, not from the king, but from his courtiers. They are manipulating him. It's one of these binding agreements that he can't get out of it. And it just reminds us that actions have consequences. So he has set this whole thing in motion. And at the end of it, he finds himself thinking, hang on, I loved her. And now I've lost her. I've lost her because I made a stupid request of her. I've lost her because I listened to my courtiers. But she's gone forever now. So there is a little bit of a crisis going on, because these courtiers realize the more the king sits around wishing he hadn't banished Vashti forever, the more he's going to mill over. Whose idea was that? Remind me. They're very fond of gallows in the Persian Empire. So actions have consequences. But they come up with a genius solution. Let's have the beauty contest to end all beauty contests. Miss Empire. And we will get the most beautiful women from the whole of the empire. And you can pick amongst them and choose whoever you want as a future queen. He's had second thoughts. He's missing Vashti. So this brilliant idea comes out. Let's find him a gorgeous girl. Enter Esther. There's some controversy over this. There are those who would argue that Mordecai shouldn't have been where he was because many of the exiles had returned. And Esther should not have been involved in this empire-wide beauty contest. I would contest both of those ideas. Mordecai is following a well-known kind of Jewish practice. He's a man of influence in the land, and the Jews remain dispersed. They've always been a dispersed people, and they served the empires in which they were, and they sought to be salt and light within them. Esther was taken. Doesn't say she volunteered. She didn't enter a competition and go. She was taken. She would have been known. She lived in Susa. That's where Mordecai lived. She would have been known. She was an exceptionally beautiful girl. And someone would have said, right, amongst all these different candidates, we don't know how many there were, but amongst all these different candidates, that good-looking girl from that street, she needs to be one of them. And so my view is very simply that one day officials would have come and said, Esther, come with us. And she would have had no choice in the matter whatsoever. So I don't think we can see her as an immoral girl who kind of puts herself in this position. She has no choice. And she is, after all, being groomed, possibly to be the queen. There are echoes of Daniel in this. If you have a look at chapter 2 and verse 9, let me just read chapter 2 and verse 9. And the young woman pleased him and won favor, and he quickly provided her with cosmetics, a portion of food, with seven chosen women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Just as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel found favor with the servants of the king Nebuchadnezzar in their day. So something about Esther's character is so winsome that the eunuch in charge of the harem brings her to kind of prominence. But Esther has a secret. Mordecai has, with great forethought, said to her, do not let your nationality be known. Don't let anybody know that you're a Jew. And that will play into the drama that's coming. So she goes in, and the scriptures tell us the king fell in love with her. It appears to have been more than simply that of all these good-looking women, she was the best-looking woman. The king actually loved her, and so he made her his queen, and everything seems kind of fine. She's chosen by the king. Then the story seems to go off at a tangent. There is a plot which is uncovered by Mordecai. The two people we mentioned earlier on, Bigthana and what was the other guy's name? I've just forgotten his name. Teresh, thank you. Bigthana and Teresh, they've got something against the king, and they're plotting to kind of kill him. Mordecai hears about it. He reports it. They are arrested. They're tried. They're found guilty. And they're executed. And that's all that happens. There's no preferment for Mordecai or anything. It appears that God has overlooked what he's done. It appears that his good deed has not been rewarded by either the king or by God. But God doesn't pay all his debts, does it? So there's recording and there's remembrance. If you look at those verses, they were great record keepers. And sometimes keeping good records can really kind of save you. We saw that in the book of Nehemiah, didn't we? You know, when they said, oh, these are a terrible people and they're doing illegal things. They shouldn't be building the wall. They search the records and they find, no, these are not. These people have authority to do this. And they kept their records. They knew what they were doing. And so this incident is recorded, but it's buried in the paperwork. It's absolutely buried in the paperwork. The justice of God is both the terror of sinners and the joy of saints. And we'll see that as the story unfolds. Because God is no man's debtor, is he? God will always reward that which is good, and he will always punish that which is evil. But he doesn't always do it at the moment that we think it should be done. He has his own perfect timings as well as his own perfect justice. So enter, boo, the villain, Haman. His pride is fed if you look into chapter 3. Whoops. After these things, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, depending what version you've got, promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. He's now in a position fairly equivalent to that Joseph was in the Genesis story. He is elevated, but you notice he is an Agagite. Now, the Agagites were a sub-clan of the Amalekites, and these were the people that Saul, the first king of Israel, disobeyed God and did not eradicate. And this has come back to bite them. Because if you look through the book of Esther, he always refers to Mordecai as Mordecai the Jew. And you can almost hear him spitting the word out. There's a lot more involved in this story than simply his dislike of Mordecai as a man. And that'll unfold as you see the story. So his pride is fed. He's now the top guy in the country. And the thing he likes, little people always like a big fuss, don't they? Have you noticed that? Little people love a big fuss. And so everywhere he goes, I don't mean physically little people, I mean little people morally. So, you know, every time Haman comes out, it's, oh, good morning, Haman. How are you, Haman? Three bags full, Haman. You know, everybody is kind of feeding the pride of Haman, except Mordecai. When everybody comes past, it's good morning, you know, Haman, your honor, sir, your boss. Mordecai comes by, good morning, just carries on with his work. And this gets under Haman's skin. He really, really does not like this. Everybody bowed down, they paid homage, but Mordecai did not bow down, verse 2, nor pay homage. It's even suggested that this is transgressing the king's command, though there's no reference to that being a command. And they spoke to him day after day, and they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them he was a Jew. While Esther has kept her nationality a secret on Mordecai's instructions, Mordecai hasn't. And he's doing a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He is saying, you know, I will not bow down. I will not treat you as if you were some kind of God. Pride, in a sense, is the God grandfather, isn't it, of all sins. It's the first sin in the Bible. You know, we want to be like God. That's pride. And so many sins follow after pride. And pride, I think, as well as hatred for the Jews as a people, is what motivates Haman all the way through. So, the plot then becomes kill the Jews. Verse 7 I've called trusting to luck, because they cast the runes, they throw the dice, they consult the horoscopes every day to find out what is the most propitious time to move against against Mordecai. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur. You remember at the end of the book, they celebrate the first of Purim, which is the casting of lots, before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to the king, he now feels this is the propitious moment. He's taken the auguries, if you like. He's examined the chicken livers, and you know they were all into this, weren't they? The Caesars, the Roman Caesars, Hitler was very much into this. He used to consult with astrologers and so on as part of his plans as to how he would, you know, invade Poland or Britain or wherever. Superstitious people trust to luck, and he is quite willing for his own purposes to deceive the king, because he comes to the king and he says, look, there's a pernicious group of people spread throughout your land. They have different customs, that's true. They have different laws, but there's no suggestion that they didn't keep the laws of the land. It's just that they had their own laws, their food laws and their moral laws and so on, which didn't conflict. They were rendering both to Caesar and to God. But that's not the way in which Haman presents them. They're presented as a dangerous people who are, well, they need to be rooted out. And so a vast sum of money is set aside. The king abdicates his authority. He says, oh, do what you like. You know, here's the signet ring. You want to get rid of them, you get rid of them. Here's the signet ring. You devise a law. You pass it and stamp my ring on it. And that's quite fine. Another weakness of Xerxes. He just abdicates his God-given authority as a ruler of his people. And so disaster looms. If you look at verses 12 to 15, let's find the exact wording. Look at the strength of this. Letters were sent by couriers, verse 13, to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, kill, and annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children in one day. This is genocide at an incredible rate, isn't it? And the Persian Empire was highly organized. It was vast, but they had these couriers that moved, and they would take out these edicts, and the day was specified, and all the Jews knew that at the moment that midnight on that night, 1 minute past midnight, everyone in the empire would be honor bound to try and kill them. This is going to be, there's nowhere to hide when you've got an empire as vast as that and everybody's got you marked and the Jews have never made a secret of who they are. This is going to be annihilation on an incredible scale. But unfortunately for Haman, it's also a matter of salvation. Because if the Jewish race is destroyed, where is the Messiah going to come from? If David's line is extinguished, where is the Messiah going to come from? And so Haman has overreached himself in a dreadful way. He's pushed the whole thing too far. And he's now not simply opposing Mordecai. He's not simply deceiving the king. He's actually at war with God. And there's no prizes for winning who's going to win that war. So having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout all the kingdom of Xerxes. It is a deliberate racial annihilation. So, Esther now finds herself in an incredibly difficult position. Chapter 3 ends with the saying that the whole of Susa was in turmoil. Because these Jews were not despised throughout the empire, that they were regarded as good citizens, they were good workers, they had good reputation. And the idea of participating in this kind of genocide doesn't sit well with the people. So there is weeping and there's wailing. But Esther has knowledge of what's going on and also a responsibility. But that responsibility actually endangers her life. Because when Mordecai tells her that she needs to, I'm going to say man up, but that's the wrong expression completely, isn't it, for Queen Esther. She needs to go to the king and sort this matter out. And she says to him, but you know the law. If anybody enters the king's presence without being summoned, it's instant death. There's no trial. There's no imprisonment. You are grabbed, whoever you are, queen or not, you are grabbed, taken outside and executed. There's only one hope for you, and that's if the king, when he catches your eye, extends the scepter towards you. And that grants mercy. And Esther, not surprisingly, is reluctant to go down that line. She says, look, it's been a whole month since the king has summoned me into his presence. It doesn't seem the best of times. I'm not really in favor at the moment. And Mordecai is really quite forthright, isn't he? Whether if you have a look, let me find the verse I'm looking for. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai's message is very clear. And it's kind of threefold, isn't it? He says, look, God is going to save his people. There's no two ways about that. Can't you see that he's put you here at this moment to be the agency of that salvation? If you're not willing to risk everything for him, then he will find another way of saving his people. But you may well perish. Don't think your royal status is going to protect you. It isn't. And so she knows she must either trust God or perish. So she asks for time of fasting. She asks the Jews around Susa to fast, and she and her women are going to fast, and they will seek the face of God. Maybe this is a point just to speculate. Why God's name isn't mentioned? Why prayer isn't mentioned? We're not told. But one of the speculations is that the book was written at a time when it needed to be, a little bit like the book of Revelation and some of John's later letters, needed to be written in code. And so everybody would know that God is involved in this because this is Jewish people. Everybody will know that with fasting goes prayer. And so they can read between the lines. But in verse 17, Mordecai then went away and did everything that Esther had ordered him. And that's quite a challenge to her, isn't it? If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. It doesn't even say may perish, will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. I think it's so encouraging to us, isn't it, to know that God has already placed people where he needs them. Just as he did with Joseph. Joseph is already in Egypt when the famine comes, already there to save. Esther is already where she needs to be to save. Everything in God's plan. With most sort of, it's true with chess, it's even true with something like snooker. If you play snooker at the kind of way I do it, you're lucky to pot the ball, and if the cue ball goes somewhere useful where you can pot a colour after it, well, that's bonus time, isn't it? Should you then end up on another red and can pot that, you're really on a roll. But a professional player will be playing a ball 10 balls ahead. He'll want that ball there so he can get that ball there, so he can get that one there. And they're strategizing the whole thing. And of course, God is the supreme strategist, isn't he? There's nothing hidden to him. He's always planning. So even if we find ourselves in a time of real difficulty, God already has the solution. It's already in place. It's just waiting the moment for his revealing. So she must go before the king. And she needs to be appropriately dressed. I'll come back to half my kingdom in a second. The king extends the scepter. She doesn't die. And he says, what do you want? Ask what you like. Up to half the kingdom and I'll give it to you. And she makes a very modest request about a meal. And that's, everything is there okay. And then if you look at verse 5. You find verse 5, I've lost it. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, what is your wish? And it shall be granted. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. And Esther answered, my wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them tomorrow. I will do as the king has said. So Haman is now, you know, she was offered half the kingdom and she chooses a meal with me. You know, how great am I? You know, this is absolutely wonderful, isn't it? Well, what is your petition? It will be given. Does that remind you of anything in the New Testament? No?
John the Baptist.
Yeah. It's the same wording, isn't it? That Herod, when Herodias' daughter dances for him, and he's drunk, and he says, what do you want? Up to half the kingdom, and it's yours. And she says, give me the head of John the Baptist on a platter, now. So, little echoes there. There's a brief moment of joy for Haman in verse 9, and Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But on his way home, he passes Mordecai, and that's it. You know, he's raining on his parade. This is what's going on here. And Mordecai neither rose nor trembled before him, and he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh, and Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above all the officials and the servants of the king. And Haman said, even Queen Esther, let alone one but me to come. Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I'm invited with her. Yet all of this is worth nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He's got everything except this wretched thorn in his side, Mordecai. And so he is really keen. And this is where Zeresh's bit of advice comes in. Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made in the morning and go to the king and ask to have Mordecai hung on the gallows. Ah, he sleeps well that night. The following day, he's going to see his arch enemy dangling from this massive great gallows in the center of Susa. But that's why we sang the song, fading is the worldling's pleasure. All his boasted pomp and show, solid joys and lasting treasure, none but Zion's children know. All of his riches, his preferments, his wealth, God's going to take them off him in a moment. They're going to vanish. They're not lasting treasure. So, oh, coincidence of coincidences. The king can't sleep. Like mine, his internet is down, so he can't watch the television or do his emails. What is he going to do to pass the time? Somebody can come and read him a bedtime story. So he gets one of his officials to come in, read a bedtime story. You know, what would you like, Your Majesty? You know, the Three Bears? Or oh, read me one of the archives. So they rustle through the archives and, oh, coincidentally, they pick up the scroll that refers to the plot of Bigthana and Teresh. And the king kind of says, oh, well, what did we ever do for the man that kind of, you know, he's got to the end of the story and there's no reference to any reward or something. He says, well, what do we do? You know, do we knight him or something or give him an OBE or give him a lot of money? What did we do? He saved my life. And they have a look and they say, well, nothing at all. So the king is kind of wondering what to do. And as he's kind of turning it over in his mind, enter Haman. Comes just wandering coincidentally through the door. And the king says, oh, Haman, come here. What should the king do for somebody he longs to honor? And you can see this man's pride and how it's going to destroy him. He kind of thinks, he's got to mean me. It can't be anybody else he's talking about here. And so he comes up with this outrageous sort of plan about wearing the king's clothes and riding on the king's horse and having a courtier kind of lead the horse through the things. Remember, he's come into the king's presence to ask to hang Mordecai on a 90-foot gallows. And the king says, yeah, great idea. Go and do it for Mordecai. Oh, his parade is really rained on now. You can just imagine as he gives him the clothes and he brings the horse out of the stable. He's, you know, he's really, really, really not a happy man any longer. But he's got to be obedient. It's a kind of bitter obedience. But he's actually doomed to destruction. Verse 13, Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. They suddenly switch and they say, oh, now you're in trouble. Mordecai is on the ascendancy. You are his sworn enemy. It's going to come out what you've done. You've had it. You're finished. Because God's people are the apple of his eye, aren't they? Nobody can stretch out their hands against God's people and just walk away. He loves his people and he cares for and he protects his people. So we come to the death of Haman. The queen's petition is fulfilled. He comes and he just knows that everything is kind of going wrong. You come to verse 6. and Esther said, a foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman. And Haman was terrified before the king because she's saying, look, I'm going to be killed and all my people are going to be killed. And the king says, who's done this? And she says, him. This wicked Haman, and the king is so cross, and he's a little bit drunk again, and so he kind of goes out to cool down a bit. While he goes out to cool down a bit, Haman kind of throws himself on Queen Esther for mercy. The king comes back and thinks he's attacking the queen. End. He's finished. So the king's wrath. The enemy dead. But the problem hasn't gone away. Because you remember that the law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be changed. So the edict for the destruction of the Jews remains in force. And the moment that day dawns, there is still a legal obligation on everyone in the empire to kill all the Jews. So although you've got rid of the plotter, the problem doesn't go away. So what comes next is the edict, or what I've called the edict of salvation. If you jump on into chapter 8. On that day, Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. They get everything that they should deserve. Everything that was Haman's is now Mordecai. And the king, Esther speaks to the king in verse 3. She fell at his feet and wept and pleaded with him to avert the evil plan of Haman the Agagite and the plot that he had devised against the Jews. Her plan is there in verse 5. If it please the king and I found favor in your sight, and if this thing seems right before the king and I am pleasing in his sight, this is not a proud woman, is it? This is somebody pleading for her people. An edict to be written. So the petition is elaborated before the king, and another unchangeable edict is written. Look at the wording of it in 7 and 8. Verse 8, but you may write as you please with regard to the Jews in the name of the king, seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed cannot be altered. And so they choose a day. The second edict is, and it's written in almost the exact wording of the original edict, on that day, any Jew who is attacked has the right to defend themselves with arms, and they can defend their lives, destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any people or province that may attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. So while the population may be permitted to attack the Jews now have the army, if you like, on their side, the police on their side, the officials on their side, and anyone that attacks them can be destroyed. It is a self-defense decree, and a necessary one. And although the wording is the same, it's deliberately the same, I think, to reflect. If you want to destroy God's people, beware, because the hand of God will destroy you. And that's what happens. The second edict goes out. Mordecai is exalted again, and there is a time of joy throughout the empire. The tables are turned, and the people work. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them. So then comes the great celebration. The Feast of Purim, which is still celebrated by the Jews to this day, it's one of their joyful feasts. It's a party, it's a celebration, it's carnival time. It's not mandated by the Word of God, but it was instituted within the Word of God. So it's in a slightly different category to unleavened bread and Passover and Sabbath and other things. And so it ends in chapter 10 with Mordecai being the kind of the leader of everything, and he it's a very short, for Mordecai the Jew, verse 3, was second in rank to King Ahasuerus. He was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. So you have a plot being worked out that is for the salvation of God's people, and you have pride being crushed, you have good deeds being rewarded, you have answers to prayer, or prayer isn't mentioned, and what you do see is the hand of God.